From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about environmental issues and sustainability. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak. Well, it's winter, and that can only mean one thing, at least down in the Salt Lake Valley, and that's bad air.
In fact, it's already shown up with poor air quality episodes appearing down there, including a few days last week.
That's right. And every time there's an inversion and the bad air settles in, the usual suspects are rounded up and blamed. Refineries, mining operations, vehicles, Stericycle, etc. But there's another suspect which may have a bigger influence than you'd think. And that's wood-burning fireplaces and cooking stoves.
So joining us during the first half of the show will be Carrie Kelly. She is a researcher at the University of Utah and the lead author of a recent study that looked at air quality along the Wasatch Front, including the impact of wood burning and cooking operations has on the levels of PM 2.5 in the Salt Lake Valley.
Right. And in the second half of the show, we'll speak with Dr. Michelle Hoffman. She is an assistant clinical professor at the U who specializes in evaluating the impacts poor air quality has on humans, particularly children.
So we'll talk about all that and then some news highlights, including Fukushima's nuclear reactors decommissioning, which is not an easy process.
You will not believe how complicated that is just
That's
to do
right.
a little bit.
That's right.
Go over
then
that.
The EPA's new renewable fuel standards. And finally, some good news on the latest info on the gas and oil leases in the San Rafael Swell in
right.
southern Utah.
And, of course, you can join in on today's discussion by posting your questions or comments to our Facebook page, KPCW This Green Earth.
The environment and our connections to it. That's This Green Earth, and it all gets started right after these words from our underwriters. Stay tuned.
This is Doug Wells, and Monday on Mound Money, you've seen him on cable TV, John Taffer from the show Bar Rescue.
And this is Larry Warren. John takes down and out bars, administers some tough love, and turns them around. It makes for entertaining television, and Monday, entertaining radio.
So join us for Mountain Money this Monday at 9 after NPR News.
Brought to you by Park City Realty Group, Mountain West Bank, Park City Chamber Bureau, and Iron Mountain Group.
Are you a treasure hunter? Do you like to upscale and find creative ways to reuse materials? Volunteering at the Park City Restore gives you the first look at donations. Your gift of time means more affordable housing services are available through Habitat for Humanity, and you get first peek at the daily stream of Restore donations. Learn how you can get involved at habitat-utah.org. Click on the big yellow volunteer button. Habitat for Humanity of Summit and Wasatch Counties is a nonprofit organization.
Welcome back to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues and concepts of concepts of sustainability. I'm Chris Cherniak. She's Nell Larson across the board. And today the show is all about air quality.
That's right.
And not necessarily the good kind. Why would we want to talk about good air quality when, you know, we're an environmental show?
We'll get there one day.
We want to talk about poor or bad or challenging air quality.
And, that's right. Room for improvement.
Yes. And nowhere is there more room for improvement down in the Salt Lake Valley, particularly during the wintertime when inversion set in and the bad air comes with it for days at a time and at a very unhealthy level sometimes. So the challenge is to try to figure out what are the sources of this polluted air, of this air pollution. And a recent paper came out, study done by University of Utah researchers, scientists, looking at the potential contribution of wood-burning stoves and cooking operations. And the lead author of that joins us by phone. Her name is Carrie Kelly. She is, among other things, an environmental engineer. It's always good to have a fellow environmental engineer on the show. And she's here to talk about her paper and the findings. Carrie, thanks for joining Nell and myself.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Let's start with, you know, this question. Basically, what was the overall initial objective of the research of your paper?
So our goal was to figure out where particles come from, especially during our wintertime inversions. And this is a very different way of looking at where particles come from than the state typically uses. The state typically uses an inventory, which is a kind of an accounting method to figure out where particles come from. So this is a very nice complement to the inventory.
Okay. So what did you do? What did the experiment involve?
So we take particle compositions and compare them to known source signatures. So particles that come from a wood-burning stove are going to look different than particles that come from a diesel vehicle.
Hmm.
So we use that information, and we took particle composition that's available from the state from 429 days at the Hawthorne station and then about 230 days at the Linden and Bountiful stations. And using that composition information together with some tools known as receptor models, we can then get a pretty good estimate of where particles come from.
So has this research done before? This seems like really important information when we talk about air quality quite a bit. Have other scientists looked at this?
Oh, these types of methods are used throughout the country and throughout the world. Hundreds, thousands of studies have been done using these types of techniques. There have been a few studies done along the Wasatch Front by some researchers at BYU, but those studies were pretty short in duration. We were lucky enough to be able to get years of data. And the more data points you have, the better your statistics are, and so you're better able to make these attributions to different types of sources.
Okay, so you collected months and months worth of
years.
Oh, I'm sorry, years of air samples. Took them into the lab, analyzed them, broke them down, and what did you see inside this air?
We saw contributions from various sources,
mm-hmm.
and we saw contributions from crustal material and wind-blown dust. We saw contributions from diesel engines, gasoline engines, and then we saw contributions from wood smoke and cooking. And unfortunately, our methods couldn't resolve differences between wood smoke and cooking because they have their signatures are similar.
Hmm.
So, when we compared this to the state inventory, we noticed that the contributions from wood burning and cooking were quite a bit higher than the state inventory suggested. So that's been interesting. So it's helped them actually refine their inventory and their state implementation plan for fine particulate matter.
So can you clarify what you mean by crustal material?
Oh, sure. That's basically anything that the wind blows around. So this is dust. We live in a relatively dusty place. So this is soil material.
Okay. And those are things that are probably more common at certain times of year,
yes,
of the year than others.
Yes. And we also use that type of information when various types of – we're seeing signatures of various things at various times of year or on days when it's windy or on days when we're affected by a local wildfire. I use that type of information as well to help me identify sources.
Okay.
So did you see similar results between those three stations?
Yes. I guess, I'll say between Hawthorne and Linden we did. Bountiful was just kind of strange, and we're not quite sure why our results were not as good in Bountiful, but we did see similar results in Linden and at the Hawthorne monitoring station.
Hmm. And going back, you said that the state has their own inventory of what they estimated wood smoke was contributing to air quality. You found something, like you say, quite a bit different. Can you tell us the difference, the magnitude and difference between what you saw and what the state was saying should be or might be there?
So we saw wood smoke and cooking were probably 3 to 5 times higher than the state inventory suggested. So it was quite a bit higher. But I guess on the other hand, when the state performs its inventory, some of the data is really high quality. So, for example, if you are an industry, you often have to measure the concentration of pollutants that you're emitting and report and pay on how much you emit. There are sophisticated models for measuring vehicle emissions and fuel consumption. But things like wood burning, there's a lot more uncertainty in that data. So I guess it's not a huge surprise that a source like something like wood burning that's based on these emission factors and populations, that we might come up with something that's a bit different than the state.
Okay.
And I guess I should also mention that since the study was published and around the same time EPA came out with some new guidance on wood burning emission factors, and the state has since refined its inventory based on those two sources of information.
Okay. So give us an idea of the percentages of what's coming from gasoline vehicles, mm-hmm. diesel vehicles.
Yeah, this has been a challenging question, and it's been a challenging thing to try to present as a researcher. I think the best thing I can say is that if you looked at particles during an inversion, let's say when particle concentrations exceed 20 micrograms per cubic meter, the contributions from wood burning and cooking are greater than 10%. The contributions from gasoline vehicles are also greater than 10%. And I can't tell you how much greater because this starts to get complicated. But I'll do my best.
Okay.
So the particles that I can follow are the ones that are directly emitted as particles. So, for example, soot that comes from a diesel engine, that's easy for me to track. But during our wintertime inversions, about two-thirds of the particles we see on a filter are due to indirect reactions, and about one-third are direct reactions. So I'm seeing a large contribution from wood smoke in my direct particulate matter. But I also know that both wood burning and gasoline-fueled vehicles also emit volatile organic compounds and NOx.
Right.
So they contribute to the indirect formation of particulate matter as well.
Okay.
So the state has some good estimates for that contribution from gasoline vehicles, but we don't have that estimate yet for wood stove. So I can't really tell you a total number other than it's greater than 10%.
Okay. And when you're talking particulate matter, we're talking PM 2.5?
Correct.
And that is what we'll talk to Dr. Hoffman in the second half of the show about the environmental health impacts associated with PM 2.5. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Carrie Kelly. She is a research associate at the Institute for Clean and Secure Energy at the University of Utah. Actually, tell us give us a little background on who the Institute of Clean and Secure Energy is.
Sure. We are we're interested in looking at improving the process of the efficiency and reducing emissions from various types of energy sources. And we've been traditionally focused more on fossil, so not very not the latest and greatest, but trying to improve what we've got.
Okay. So this paper again was looking at the contribution that wood burning is making to air quality in a solvay and cooking. And now wood burning. Well, this is wood burning fireplaces, residential fireplaces, commercial fireplaces, wood burning pizza joints. These are the sources that you're talking about. And there's tens of thousands of them,
yeah.
Potentially.
Well, yeah, and in fact, I don't think there's a great estimate of exactly how many there are.
Mm. Okay, that sounds like a graduate paper
is.
If there ever is.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you're interested, contact Carrie Kelly. So some of the particulate matter that you talk about in this paper are things that we've talked about already that we're familiar with relatively, you know, diesel fuel or gas burning or wood, you know, particulates from wood stoves. But then there are some secondary compounds that you talk about, like ammonium nitrate and ammonium chloride. Mm. How do these fit into the picture?
Yes. So this is where it starts to get a little bit more complicated. But so there are emissions from a variety of sources in our valley. Some of the same things we talked about, diesel engines, gasoline engines, wood burning, and then there are emissions also from volatile organic compounds from like adhesives and sealants and consumer products. So what happens is you get volatile organic compounds and NOx and sulfur dioxide. These also react in our environment in the valley with ammonia, and we happen to be a very ammonia-rich environment. So once we get all this together in the mix during our valley in the winter, we get the formation of ammonium nitrate, ammonium sulfate, and ammonium chloride. And I should also mention that ammonium chloride was another interesting finding in our paper.
Yeah, talk about that. where the chloride's coming from.
Yeah, so that is really interesting. So I guess I should also mention that ammonium chloride is not very common. So many of these other things that we're seeing on our filters are seen in other parts of the country in the world. But ammonium chloride is more unusual. And so so we're interested in where does the chlorine come from, and also what's the contribution. So we saw on inversion days, especially on the dirtier inversion days, like when we have concentrations above 30 micrograms per cubic meter, we were seeing somewhere in on the order of 10% contribution from ammonium chloride, which is enough to spark your interest.
Hmm.
So the chlorine could be coming from three things, we think. We're not sure, but these are, we believe, are the three most likely candidates. One is the Great Salt Lake and the surrounding salt marshes.
Hmm.
The other is U.S. magnesium. And then the final one is road salt.
Interesting. And you can't fingerprint one versus the other.
No, this would require quite a bit further study. So there are some ideas about how to do this. And I think the Division of Air Quality is very interesting and interested in figuring out more. And so, yeah, this is a future research question.
Okay. But ammonium chloride is contributing to PM2.5?
Yes, it is.
Okay. So all these things, all these different compounds are contributing to levels of PM2.5. Okay.
You know, it's particularly interesting to me to hear that the road salt is having an impact on.
Well, I guess I should say that we're not sure which one of those it is.
Right.
It could be that road salt is not at all responsible. In fact, we think it's less likely, but we're just not sure.
Okay.
So I wouldn't point my finger at any one of those yet. And it could be that, for example, the Great Salt Lake and surrounding marshes generate so much chlorine that it overwhelms anything else. So it could be that there's nothing that could realistically be done about it. But we just don't know.
Okay.
Well, that kind of segues to my question. What's next? What would you like to study further?
Okay, so for on the wood smoke, and maybe I'll answer this in two parts. I'll answer research and then a little bit on policy.
Mm-hmm.
On the research side, we'd like to be able to differentiate between wood smoke and cooking. And there's a way to do that using carbon-14 signatures. So that's what used to date fossils.
Mm.
And so we're talking to the Division of Air Quality and some people with at the University of California, Irvine, who have the capability to do this. And we're talking about a study this winter to gather samples and to try to figure out of that contribution from that I'm saying is wood smoke cooking, what fraction is wood smoke and what fraction is cooking. I guess we'd also like to see some additional study of ammonium chloride and where that might come from. And then I guess there's some potential, this could lead to some policy or some practical changes with regard to wood burning, because I think a lot of people didn't think it was very important, and now that we have some information showing that it is something that's certainly worth a closer look, the Division of Air Quality is going to be starting up a working group, and people have some very, very strong feelings about burning wood, and so
sure.
I think it would be very valuable to get some of these people around the table to come up with some of the best strategies.
Sure, I mean, let's face it, wood burning is that's my fireplace. This is a quality of life issue.
Yeah, and I've had a number of angry phone calls.
You have?
Yes, I have.
Pro wood burners.
Wow.
Out there.
Yeah, there are some very pro wood burners out there.
Right. I mean, and for some people, it's probably it is the sole source of heat for a house.
It
so it has, you know.
Yeah, and in fact, there are approximately 230 people in the non-attainment area for PM2.5 who are listed as sole source burners. So this means that they are, they say that their house is solely heated by wood or coal,
mm-hmm.
and they are allowed to burn all winter long, even when the state calls a no-burn day.
Right. I hope there aren't homes that are burning coal.
Well, I am told that there are, but I'm not sure.
Okay. But the point is, yeah, this gets to people's, personal personal, you know, use for recreation, not recreation, but comfort or so, to have a fire going. So, and there's voluntary, the state does have voluntary requests on bad air days that people restrict their wood burning activities.
Well, in fact, I think it goes even further than that. And and recently the Air Quality Board passed a rule that allows the state to call mandatory no-burn days even earlier. So before 2011, the state waited until we reached national ambient air quality standards, mm-hmm. which for PM2.5 are 35 micrograms per cubic meter. And at that point, they called mandatory no-burn. Now they call it at 25 micrograms per cubic meter, with the option of calling it even earlier if poor air quality is forecast. So I think they're moving. Actually being more proactive and working with the air quality forecast makes a whole lot of sense with regard to wood burning and people's and any kinds of actions people can take during our inversions.
You know, I was just going to ask a question along the same lines. Do you and the other researchers involved in this paper have any plans to work with, you know, the local groups that focus on these issues, like the Utah Physicians for a Healthy Environment or Sierra Club or things
Breathe
along
Utah.
Those lines?
Yeah. Right.
So that is an interesting question. So, and this is a particularly interesting question for me personally. I think our goal as researchers is to provide good quality, objective research, and let the people with expertise in policy and who are really advocating for different actions take the leadership role on that. And I'm always happy to talk to, and I have talked to a number of these groups about our research results and what they mean, mm-hmm. and just generally talked about ideas of what might make sense in terms of technical reduction strategies.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm also on the State Air Quality Board, so I want to help spark the discussion, but since we're a policymaking entity, I can't really get involved in lobbying the board for any particular action. Does that make sense?
It sure. does. So you're providing the background information yeah. that people can use to move forward.
Exactly.
Right. Okay. So, Carrie, how can people get or learn more about this subject and your paper? Where can they go online to find it?
So if you look at if you go to the Division of Air Quality website, if you go back to the June meeting, I gave a presentation, and people can, that's up on their website, so you can go to the Division of Air Quality board meeting. But if you go back to the June agenda, you'll find that presentation. And people are also welcome to contact me, and I can send them a full copy of the paper. They can ask me more detailed questions if they feel like it.
Okay.
And is there an email address?
Oh, sure. It's Carrie, K-E-R-R-Y, .Kelly, K-E-L-L-Y, at utah.edu.
Perfect.
All right. So I'll say this. If I owned a gas-fired fireplace business, I'd have your paper poster sign.
Framed on the wall.
In the window.
Well, I guess that brings up another thing that if you look at the presentation of the Air Quality Board, if you look at the ratio of emissions from a wood-burning fireplace to a natural gas-type burner, they are orders of magnitude higher for wood-burning, both in terms of direct PM2.5
right.
and volatile organic compounds. So if you wanted to make a choice to do something good for the air quality in the winter, especially during the inversion season, I would choose not to burn wood, or maybe replace my wood with a natural gas.
Sure, that's what I did. Fantastic.
And well, yeah, good for you.
And yeah, thank you. Okay.
Go, Chris.
Do what I can. Just wonderful. Great conversation. Thanks again so much for joining us, Carrie Kelly. She's a research associate, among other things, at the Institute for Clean and Secure Energy down at the University of Utah. I think this is a subject we will probably be staying in touch with you about, Carrie, going
okay,
forward.
Okay, thanks a lot. I'm thrilled that people are interested.
Okay. Thanks again. And let's take a break for some underwriters. And when we come back, we're going to talk about the health impacts associated with PM2.5 and other bad air components down in the Salt Lake Valley. It's This Green Earth. Stay tuned.
As the world evolves, so do our roles. At the Intermountain, Park City, Bonanza, and Round Valley Clinics, we have defined ours for you. I'm Dr. Lisa Saturnino, and excited to announce that the Bonanza Clinic is now a full-time InstaCare, exclusively for the urgent medical needs of our community. Our great partners at the Round Valley Clinic will now be the primary care experts. We are happy to provide expert care close to home. Intermountain Healthcare is a nonprofit organization.
Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper. Join me for The Splendid Table, an hour of lively and informative conversation and your calls about the first love in just about everyone's life, food. From in-depth looks at America's food chain to conversations with cheesemakers in the hills of Sicily, food is a doorway to great adventure. So join us. That's The Splendid Table from 8 p.m.
Join KPCW every Sunday morning at 9 for The Splendid Table, sponsored by River Horse on Main.
This is Matt Mitten, estate planning attorney with Jones Waldo, a Park City law firm. Longtime supporters of KPCW, we've been providing clients legal services since silver and not snow drove the Park City economy. Our website is joneswaldo.com and our number is 435-200-0085.
This is Tom Roney with Prudential Utah Real Estate, and we're happy to support KPCW. Prudential Utah has been helping locals and visitors with their real estate needs since 1976. Our agents know the community and the local market. More information can be found online at prud-utah.com or at one of our 14 offices throughout Park City.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson, and that's Chris Cherniak across the board. And on the phone with us for the second half of the show is Dr. Michelle Hoffman. She's assistant clinical professor at the University of Utah, medical director of Riverton Hospital's Children's Unit, and the department chair of pediatrics at the Riverton Hospital. Her research includes quality improvement in the hospital setting and children's environmental health. She's currently the principal investigator on a multi-year grant from the Centers for Disease Control that's focusing on the environmental management of pediatric asthma. So she's here to talk with us about how the particulate matter that we just talked about in the first half of the show is affecting our health and the health of the children in this area. So Dr. Hoffman, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So why don't you start by telling us a little bit about how you got into this field and involved in environmental health?
Well, for the first part of my career as a pediatrician, I was a stay-at-home mom mostly and worked nights in the hospital as a pediatrician. And I was raising two small children. And every night shift I would work where I was slammed with tons of respiratory admissions, when I'd get in my car and leave the children's hospital up there on the hill and look out into the dense inversion, I wondered whether those two things were linked. And so I started to get interested in it. And honestly, the thing that inspired me most was an elementary school child. I went to a public meeting on air pollution, and this young lady stood up and she sang an anti-idling song on vehicular idling reduction. And I said, gosh, if these young people can do something about this problem, myself as a pediatrician with my knowledge base and interest could probably do a whole lot. And I've been nonstop really ever since.
So what kind of cases are you getting that are coming into the hospital, you like say, with respect to kids and bad air?
It's difficult to tease out what the effects of the bad air are specifically, other than that we know it contributes significantly to breathing illnesses in children, things like asthma, respiratory infections that may have started out as a usual cold, but then you get into inversion conditions, things settle down into the lungs, cause that much more of a severe illness, enough to land a child in the emergency room or the hospital. So we're not going to say that air pollution causes you to get the flu, but we can say with good certainty that air pollution, when you have the flu, makes that disease process a lot worse.
Right.
And so we'll see more hospitalizations and higher level of care utilization as a result.
So we were speaking with Carrie Kelly about, you know, wood smoke and cooking emissions, and that's all about PM2.5. Talk to us about how PM2.5 affects children's lungs, and does it affect children's lungs any different than, say, adult lungs?
Sure. So just speaking more generally about how PM2.5 works in the lungs, it's the size of the particle that's really important. Our body has some natural defenses. We've got little hair cells in our noses that trap particles. So, for example, we do a heavy cleaning day out in our homes with a lot of dust being generated. We blow our nose, and we can see that there's particles in there. That's one of our body's natural defenses. Well, these particles are just much smaller than that and bypass those natural defenses and get down into the small air spaces of the lungs and trapped there, and then go even further into the bloodstream and cause even cardiovascular and systemic inflammation effects. But speaking specifically to the lungs, if you think about a foreign body in your lungs, your body's going to respond to that by sending out little cells to kind of clear up the mess. And that creates what we call an inflammatory response, swelling in the lungs. So our body's own response to these foreign particles is one of trying to clean up the mess, but that also causes damage and then needs to be repaired and over time can lead to small amounts of scar. And then if you have repeated exposures, for example, over a lifetime of growing up here, you can understand why the larger epidemiologic studies done on air pollution show that children's lung function is decreased, their lung growth potential is decreased over these long periods of exposure. Because of these repeated cycles of injury and repair that are occurring in the lung.
Right.
And then specifically to children in terms of why they may be more vulnerable than adults. So even beginning in utero, children are in the womb more susceptible to the harmful effects of air pollution. There's probably critical exposure times when air pollution can have more lasting effects on lung health. The lungs aren't well formed at birth, and they develop full functionality over the first 6 years or so of life. And so you can imagine if you take something that's immature and it's having to grow under less than optimal conditions, that it may be more vulnerable to injury and more permanent effects that way. And so even just developmentally, that's one way that children are more susceptible. They're also more susceptible because they tend to spend more time outdoors. When they're outdoors, they tend to be more active and are breathing faster. And they breathe about 50% more per kilogram of body weight than adults do.
Wow.
And also children tend to be more mouth breathers as well, especially the younger children. Those are bypassing the normal, those same mechanisms of filtration that we have for children that adults don't have to deal with.
So yet another
pound
reason.
For pound, they,
okay.
Yeah.
So yet another reason to breathe through your nose, because there's more of a filtration system.
Nobody likes a mouth breather.
Okay.
So what kinds of impacts does exercise have? If you're exercising in these bad environments, does this, I guess, enhance the impacts or increase the impacts?
Right. Is exercise worse for
right?
you?
So exercising exactly for the same reasons that kids are more vulnerable. When you're exercising outdoors, you're increasing your breathing rate and you're breathing in more pollutants. And so that's why the EPA recommends that on really poor air quality days, you reduce your exertion outdoors. That doesn't help people whose occupations may be outdoors that are physically strenuous, those kinds of things. And so that's, you know, for me, the way that we message around air pollution is a little problematic. It's sort of a Band-Aid to say that the air quality is poor, stay inside to protect your health.
Mm-hmm.
First off, we've got a growing obesity problem in children, and the only place that children are typically active is outdoors, and so we need to be figuring out ways to continue to stay active, to promote occupations that may be outdoors that require high exertion, while also thinking about how to better protect health when air quality deteriorates. So that's been a lot of the focus of my own work is figuring out those times when it's the safest to be outside.
Okay. We got a question from a listener. They want to know about the effects of ozone ozone, a completely different type of pollutant, different type of source, and chemical mechanics. But ozone levels can be high on actually sunny days because they require sunlight to form. So how does ozone impact lungs and respiratory and maybe cardiovascular systems?
Ozone air pollution is not dissimilar to particulate matter in the sense that it causes that same inflammatory response in the body. I think that its effects are definitely more targeted to the lung than PM2.5 in the sense that I think the greater disease endpoints that we're seeing with PM2.5 on cardiovascular morbidity and on problems are at a population level huge for particulate matter. Ozone has a little bit less of that and is more focused in on the lung, but they act very similarly in the sense that they cause this inflammatory response in the lungs. Ozone acts a bit more quickly in the sense that it's really directly toxic to the lung when you breathe it in, and you'll feel the effects of it much more quickly than necessarily with a particle that then is going to need the body to sort of respond to it. And so they're different a little in that way as well.
Right. If I understand, ozone is O3, so it's just a highly charged oxygen that's an oxidizer. So it has a way of, in effect, kind of burning or oxidizing tissue.
Exactly.
And that's what creates that inflammatory response.
Exactly. And both of them create what are called reactive oxygen species that cause oxidative stress in the body, free radicals. There's a lot of research on the role of antioxidants, for example, in mitigating some of the effects of the air pollutants. It's kind of a little bit on both sides of whether it's helpful or not, but certainly we've seen a large role for antioxidants and other health endpoints. So something to think about.
Right. Okay.
So tell us a little bit more about your grant with the Center for Disease Control that's looking at environmental management of pediatric asthma and the work that you're doing for that.
That grant is part of a national initiative that designates regionally across the country what we're called as pediatric asthma faculty champions. And our goal is, most of us are based in medical centers. Our goal is to train the future workforce in medicine to really think about the environmental management of things like pediatric asthma. So asthma is one of the biggest endpoints of where outdoor air pollutants have an effect. It's also one of our largest sources of hospitalizations for children, for example. It's a huge burden of disease in the United States for both children and adults, and we're trying to get people to take a multifaceted look at it. So outdoor air pollution is just one trigger. There are many triggers of asthma within the home as well, from dust mites to animal dander to smoke exposure from tobacco smoke, to our gas-burning appliances that have nitrogen oxides from the burning of gas fuels in the home, to poorly ventilated bathrooms that have a lot of steam, and then mold. There's multiple triggers of asthma in the home, and the best evidence is around targeting all of them. You can't just quit smoking and then have all of these other triggers and expect your asthma to be well-controlled. You really have to get in there and target all of the different potential sources of asthma triggers. And it's a lot about helping patients at the patient level identifying what things might be problematic for them and then mitigating those things. The National Heart and Lung and Blood Institute has 5 key principles, one of which is identifying environmental triggers, because then we can get at the prevention side. Then we might not need medication to control asthma on a daily basis. We might be able to do avoidance instead of medication to better control asthma. And so that's sort of the goal, is to teach future healthcare professionals. So I talk to medical students. I talk to other physicians who've been in practice a long time who might not be thinking about asthma in this way, and teach them and give them some tools to use to better assess this part of asthma control.
Right. It's interesting. You get a patient comes in and they have respiratory issues. It can be a real challenge, a real puzzle to put together all the potential sources. Like you say,
absolutely,
not just that. Indoor air quality is a big issue, particularly in the winter when we, you know, close up our homes and we're indoors a lot. There are, like you say, there's a number of different compounds, chemicals, particulates that can trigger asthmatic responses indoors. That's a whole separate discussion.
That's right. Well, and Wood Spoke is, I know that was one of the topics of, that you were discussing with Dr. Kelly this morning. And, you know, I like to think about it in this way. The wood smoke has more health effects probably in the household for the, at that individual level.
Huh.
And it's also a huge portion of our ambient air pollution problem in the wintertime locally. And so we're getting huge benefits from being able to mitigate wood smoke if we can target, say, the 300 or so sole source burners of wood smoke in their homes. The people in those homes will have huge health impacts compared to the general public, and then we'll also see regional ambient air quality improvements that will be substantial as a result of trying to eliminate that particular source. And so, you know, I like to point out that we've made amazing progress under the Clean Air Act in improving our air quality, but that we measure that at a regional sort of airshed level and not at that individual level where we there's a large body of growing evidence that individuals are disproportionately impacted by these air pollutants and what sort of health effects they have. And wood smoke is a great area to target where we're getting at individuals who are going to experience substantial health benefits as a result of avoiding those exposures, while we're also being able to target our general air quality problems at the airshed level.
So if our listeners are interested in learning more about this issue or getting involved, where would you point them?
Well, I work with a few nonprofits, which
right.
I always encourage people to get involved at that level. I think the reason that I continue to be so committed to this cause is that it's a cause, and there's grassroots motivation to do something about this and improve the problem. It's an amazingly complex problem, and it's hard to figure out what those solutions are that are actually going to make an impact. But we need grassroots support. So I work with Breathe Utah as one of the organizations I helped co-found. Please Google us and mm-hmm. look us up and volunteer or contribute your support. I also sit on the board of directors for Utah Clean Cities, which is an alternative fuels organization. They've got lots of great resources on the web to learn about how we can reduce our, become more energy independent and shift towards cleaner fuels for our vehicles, which are our major source of air pollution locally. I work with the governor on his new Clean Air Action Team,
mm-hmm.
and we're working on developing some policy recommendations for this session and next, looking at all of those strategies. Please get in touch with people at Breathe Utah. We've got representation there. We can help bring your ideas to that level and examine what might work best for our local community in terms of improving air quality. There's the city and county are doing great work around idling campaigns, the Clear the Air Challenge, with the chamber now has taken over the Clear the Air Challenge, where we're actually getting citizens out there involved in reducing their vehicle miles traveled. There's all sorts, there's so much activity on air pollution locally that it will be hard to not find something that grabs your interest, something that you might get passionate about and want to work on.
That's fantastic. Dr. Michelle Hoffman is Assistant Clinical Professor, Medical Director of Riverton Hospital's Children's Unit, and Department Chair of Pediatrics at Riverton Hospital. Again, we want to thank you for taking the time to talk to Nell and me on this really important issue about air quality. And it's the bad air quality season down there. You can see it change on a daily. Yeah, with you, Michelle.
You think you don't have it?
That's a good point. We do have it. We do have it, and if we're not careful, we're going to start getting some of yours.
Part of that's again the regional versus the individual level. So
right.
You might not have airshed issues, but if a kid's sitting in their stroller next to the tailpipe of a vehicle, they're being exposed to air pollution.
Exactly. It's mm-hmm. a good point. All right. Thanks again for joining us, Dr. Hoffman. Let's take another break for a couple of underwriters. And when we come back, we'll have some news items, including what's going on at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant. You don't want to miss that. It's This Green Earth. Stay tuned.
This is Ann from Park City Nursery and the Park City Tree Ranch, thankful to share another growing season with KPCW. For the fall season, between snow and rain showers, we stock winterizing necessities for your yard, tools and fertilizers, compost, soil prep, bulbs and seed, plus fire pits and fall decorations. We know what grows at parkcitynursery.com.
I'm John Wells.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
Join us for Cool Science Radio Thursdays at 9 a.m.
From the discovery of new dinosaurs to the science of an avalanche.
From the secret technology behind Facebook to nanotechnology.
Deciphering science and tech in an entertaining, amusing, and accessible way.
It's Cool Science Radio. If we understand it, so can you.
Thursdays at 9 a.m. only in Park City, only on KPCW.
Park City Restore is grateful for the many hands that have made it successful. Your gift of time means more affordable housing services are available locally through Habitat for Humanity. Plus, volunteering at the Restore gives you a first look at the amazing treasures donated for resale. Learn how you can get involved at habitat-utah.org. Click on the big yellow volunteer button. Habitat for Humanity of Summit and Wasatch Counties is a nonprofit organization.
Welcome back to This Green Earth, weekly talk show on environmental issues and concepts of sustainability. Time for some news items.
Yeah, we have a few highlights from the week.
I'll start with this one. Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant in Japan. We all know about that. What happened there? The earthquake and then the resulting tsunami did incredible damage to the plant. Two explosions occurred at two separate buildings, hydrogen-based explosions. And what happened is that it damaged three of the six units. Okay, there's six nuclear power units at this plant. Three of them were down at the time. They weren't operating. They still have nuclear fuel.
They were like, you know, doing safety checks and maintenance.
But they were doing checks and maintenance, et cetera. The other three were up and running. And it was those units that received the most damage, units one through three. And then unit four that was down, one of them that was down, also received some damage. So you got four units filled with these nuclear fuel rods and casings that now they're all underwater, that they're kind of stored in water to keep them cool. Otherwise, they're incredibly hot, and B, they emit unbelievable amounts of radiation, tremendous amounts of radiation. So they got to keep them in water. But they've been damaged to some degree at these four units, and now they got to take out all these rods. There are approximately 3,100 fuel rod assemblies. Each assembly holds 60 to 80 rods. So do the math. That's roughly 21, 22,000 rods that have to be removed from each unit, okay? And that started yesterday. And here's what they have to do. They have to go in. They got a crane. They can go. They pick up these rod casings, and they pick them up out of the pool, and they put them into another container filled with water. And then they have to take that container, once it's filled with all the casing that's full, take that casing, take it, pick that up with a crane, and put it down onto a truck, flatbed, and drive it, are you ready? 100 yards to another...
the massive distance.
To another safe storage area, one that is earthquake resistant, hopefully tsunami resistant.
And one of the important parts of this is that the current pool that they're being cooled in is like 100 feet off of the ground. So it's
right.
Really susceptible to any kind of earthquake, natural disaster.
Yeah, you kind of had to wonder why.
Seems precarious.
Why
up
are you
there?
Putting the pool on the fourth floor? Okay,
yeah.
But anyway, this is it's a pretty simple concept. You know, in concept, it's pretty simple. Pick up the rods, move them from one unsafe area to a safer area. You got to do it slowly, carefully, of course. The workers can only be work for 2-hour shifts. They have six shifts of six workers apiece. They work 2-hour shifts. Over a 12 or 14 hour day every day for the next year. They suspect it'll take a year to do one unit four. the least damaged of the four, and then they're going to work their way to the most damaged units. In entirety, it's expected to take somewhere around 5 to 6 years to complete all this work. And that's only
the three units that are going to be. Yeah. That doesn't even include decommissioning the rest of the other units
that aren't damaged are just going to sit there for the next 30 or 40 years to be decommissioned. This whole plant is being decommissioned. Okay, so that's what's going on at Fukushima.
That's right. And then we have some good news. We always like to share good news when we get it, about what's going on the San Rafael swell. The BLM had scheduled an upcoming auction for November 19th that was going to include 80,000 acres of oil and gas leases in the swell, which is obviously a favored recreational spot in the state. And it's considered wilderness area quality. Some people are hoping to get it designated as a wilderness area. And the gas leases included places like Eagle Canyon, Old Spanish Trail, areas near the Cleveland Lloyd dinosaur area, and Indian Canyon, which is a hot spot for rock art. American rock art.
Okay.
And so a huge number of environmental groups and citizens got together, filed petitions, filed a formal protest. And I have to read this list. The Utah Wilderness Alliance, the Sierra Club, the NRDC, the Wilderness Society, the Grand Canyon Trust, the Rocky Mountain Wild, the Utah Rivers Council, and the Great Old Broads for Wilderness filed a formal protest. The Utah Rock Art Research Association is also involved. I mean, everyone who's kind of active in this state on those issues. And then Juan Palma, the BLM state director, deferred those leases, so they won't be listed in the November 19th auction, which is really good news.
Okay, so they're deferred for now.
Right. So this isn't like a permanent victory, but it means that, you know, when you head down to the swell this winter, you're not going to see these trucks and oil development happening right away.
Okay.
And, of course, not everybody's happy, though.
Really?
Utah's Republican senators released a statement saying that this is a bait and switch and that BLM is a vehicle for the policies created by radical environmentalists.
Radical, of course.
So, yeah. So we'll see what happens. But all in all, this is getting a really positive response as a balanced approach because Juan Palma took the time to talk to these different groups and take their input into account.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Imagine that. Conversation.
A balanced approach.
Balanced approach.
Right.
Most importantly, it's deferred. It can change in the future. So
keep an eye on this issue. Okay. Currently, there are 4 million acres of lease open in Utah. Only 1 million of those acres is being used. So the argument is this area isn't needed. There are 3 million acres available. Let's leave the swell to the
recreationists. Use the land you got.
Yeah.
Use what you drill, what you got, then come back to us for more, right? Okay. That's a concept. All right. That's it for news. We've got to take one last spot for underwriters, and we come back. We'll wrap up. It's This Green Earth.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Longreimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-LAW.com. Park City Nursery. For 30 years, we know what grows. ParkCityNursery.com. VaultHomeLoans.com. Purchase and refinance mortgages. Conventional FHA and VA. 801-201-3484. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. We are here to wrap up and thank our guests and our sponsors.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's first thank our underwriters for whom this show would not be impossible. They include Jones, Waldo, Holbrook, and McDonough.
Republic Services.
Habitat for Humanity's Restore.
Rocky Mountain Power.
San Francisco Design.
And finally, Prudential Utah Real Estate.
Again, you can join us always and like us on Facebook.
That's right.
KPCW, This Green Earth.
You can email us your suggestions for future shows or questions at thisgreenearthradio@gmail.com.
And tomorrow, of course, it's The Mountain Life with Lynn Peake and Tim Henney.
That's
they always
right.
have an interesting show. We try to do as well as they can. But again, thanks to our guests. We had a pretty great show. Carrie Kelly and Dr. Michelle Hoffman talking all about air quality and health impacts associated with air quality. We posted some of that information on our Facebook page, right?
We did.
All right. So Thanks again for joining us. Join us next week. Remember that this is KPCW 91.9 FM in Park City.
Only in Park City, only on KPCW.